Namaste and in law catch, and welcome to this week's episode of One World and New World. I'm Zen Benefiel, your host. And with those two greetings, I'm going to refer you to prior videos for the full explanation of it. Just trust that they're from two different ancient languages, and applying them in your own life will make a huge difference. Don't trust me. Do your research. Try it for yourself. All right. Well, this week's guest is a very special woman. Her name is Susan Hayes, and she's got a bunch of letters after her name. But suffice it to say, she's a psychotherapist, certified hypnotherapist, a certified sex therapist, a certified life and business coach who graduated from the University of Northern Colorado with a bachelor's and two master's degrees, and that both in the area of special education and two master's degrees in education and counseling. She's the author of a really great book called Freed from Stuck, Dare to Cross the Bridge Between Grief, Trauma, and Self-Sabotage to Discover Lasting Change Now. Now, she also likes a little bit of marketing, and she's helped the only and first, maybe not only, but first nonprofit psychiatric hospital in Denver to find their way and be supportive of the community. Susie, thanks for being here.
Thank you. I am looking forward to this conversation.
Awesome. Me too. So let's just jump right in. Now, you're aware that we kind of look at the inner and outer realities and how those two become one, hopefully. Let's start with your, you know, when did you find the initial impetus or the discovery of something other than the outer world that was going on inside of you and the connection that you had with it?
It's an interesting question. As I look back over my history, I don't know that I've ever reflected quite in that way. So
we're going to have an apocalyptic moment here.
Let's have a spontaneous awareness. I grew up in a very conservative fundamentalist home, mm-hmm. and very devout in our faith. And so that was my first introduction to spirituality. And it was really over the years, my father had given me a great gift of supporting my curiosity and asking questions.
Oh, that is just so many parents do not empower, encourage, inspire their kids to be curious.
Yes, it's true. And, you know, it was actually that support of my curiosity and asking questions that moved me out of that traditional framework.
Not surprising.
To explore my own journey. And I know that at some level, perhaps at that point in time, it was a bit perplexing to my father because he was very devout, mm-hmm. but he always respected my journey. And I actually was in ministry for about 13 years. I traveled through the Assemblies of God, to the Baptist, to the Presbyterian. And I really enjoyed my work, but I came to a crossroad because I realized that my understanding of God and my relationship to God at that time, as I would have framed it, left me with a question where I couldn't understand the doctrine of original sin. I couldn't understand how we could be born separated from God.
You make a great point. I had a similar situation as a kid. I was adopted, orphaned as a newborn, adopted. And then my parents, when my sister arrived, I was 4 and a half. And so they decided it was time to tell me about my adoption. Now, that's a bit much for a 4 and a half year old. And yet it took me inside, was the beginning of my own journey, and asking questions such as, do I have a father and mother in heaven? Can I talk to them? Mm. And then found out I could. So that just totally, I couldn't talk about it, right? You have that kind of experience as a kid. You can't talk to adults about something like that because they diminish or dismiss it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, how did you bring that forth in a way that you were able to have your own experience, still be encouraged by your parents, especially your father, and make it real for you too?
Well, I was in my early 30s when I kind of came to that crossroad, and I had to make a decision to leave ministry because I felt like I could not function in that capacity because of the dissonance I was feeling. Mm-hmm. And so I had to make a choice. And so what I did was I left, but I continued my spiritual journey, and I just, I kind of became a metaphysical junkie, and I just studied everything I could find. And my journey was really one of progression. It wasn't like an aha moment per se. It mm-hmm. was really a progression of beginning to consider what I was like if I was not born in original sin. What if, in fact, I was born with divine light, always connected to God, but had only been told that I was separated?
Well, isn't that defining the disparity, those two polarities within the organized framework just don't make sense, do they?
And that was the discomfort I was feeling. It didn't match with what I understood as my experience, for example, of love.
Mm-hmm.
To be banished because you made a decision just didn't seem to resonate. And I think even as a child, I kind of had this innocent connection with God that I came to know more fully as I continued to evolve in my spiritual journey, where I really began to understand that my concept of God had been limited, and it was really a progression of sort of moving into a new languaging of my experience, where I began to experience spirit and universe and something much more vast.
And you maintain the curiosity.
Absolutely.
That seems to be the consistency, right, of that.
Even to this day. Yeah, even to this day.
Oh, me too.
Even like in this conversation.
Right.
I'm like, I'm really curious to see where we're going to go with this. Like, this could be really interesting. This could be really amazing. This could be transformative for me, for you, for those who are participating in this conversation, listening. And so, yeah, that same curiosity, that same openness in my curiosity is with me today, and I'm sure will always be with me.
I think once you recognize, or at least for me, once I recognized that curiosity was part of the journey, it facilitated all of the questions that came. And as I got better at asking questions, which are more important than the answers, right? You dive deeper, and that curiosity becomes almost fearless, because you know that truth wants to be questioned. That's how it's found.
Absolutely. And I do believe that there has to be a level of trust in order to
Absolutely.
Be curious. If it's not safe, you're not going to explore. And I think, going back to my relationship with my father, it was safe to ask questions. It was safe to challenge him. It was safe to debate with him.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he encouraged that. And so for me, asking questions was always a very safe thing. It's like,
Now, how did you deal with the unknown and the uncomfort or the feeling of it not being safe? Because you mentioned the key word trust, right? And in that trust, there's no fear. It's like, and the courage, right? I've heard courage is fear that said its prayers, right? So in that courageous activity of asking questions, how did those, the fears come up, the uncomfort, the feeling, that I use fear loosely in that sense, the feeling of lack of safety, how did you deal with that? What were the kinds of things that came up that precipitated that feeling?
I think safety for me found its foundation in love. Okay. Like I believed God was love. I maybe didn't exactly know what that meant, especially as a child, but that's what I'd been taught. God is love.
Right.
And so I trusted that. And even as I had questioned later on as a young adult, I remember saying, you know, I was sitting in chapel and the speaker was saying, with Jesus, you're never alone. And I remember saying, then why the hell do I feel so alone? And it was that ability to be honest for me in my distress. Like, I didn't get it. Like, things were good in my life, but something wasn't right. And I didn't know that that was kind of the front end of this angst with my theology, but it was. Mm-hmm. And that took me into therapy. And therapy, of course, is the task of asking good questions and exploring and being willing to go into the unknown and being able to go into potentially the past of what you have known and to know it in a new way.
Right. You, it's like what I found that in those kinds of situations, the questions are great. It's hearing yourself answer them that gives you that additional opportunity to explore deeper and the, okay, why did I say that? Or where, you know, where did that come from? And, you know, as you're exploring yourself, how did you recognize that? And as you said, you know, grow from there.
Well, that was an ongoing journey of healing the distortions and the fear-based beliefs, if you will, the trauma, abuse, disappointment in my history. All of that needed to be attended to. That needed to be healed. And so that was an ongoing process for me for a while.
Now, it's those are experiences in the outer world, right?
Yes, okay. They were experiences in the outer world, of course, that had wounded my heart. Hmm. And what I also came to understand, and this was much later in my journey, but I came to understand that even in the wounding of my heart, my soul was not damaged or hurt. And that became a really important distinction for me, because I am this being, I am this essence that has come to this planet to have this exploration. And in that exploration, I will experience the human experience, which is about fear and hurt and loss and disappointment and all of those things that we tend to frame as negative. Mm-hmm. I will come and I will experience that, and I will deal with that. I will learn through that. I will grow. I will heal. I will transform because of it, and I will come into a greater awareness of who I really am. And that's where I really came to later on in my journey, is that, yes, I had all of these experiences, but I'm not those experiences. They happened to me in my at the human level of my experience. But essentially, when I came to really know who I am, and I, by the way, I'm still exploring that, mm-hmm. right? I'm still understanding that and appreciating that. But I had to go through those dark tunnels, those dark nights of the soul. I had to go through those healing processes. And in that, I came into the greater awareness of who I am.
And without them, you couldn't have.
True. True.
Right. That's
and,
it.
The and nor would I have cultivated resilience.
Right.
In my experience, which I think is so important for us, particularly now with all of the challenges around us.
So let's unpack the resilience for just a moment, if we can.
Sure. Let's.
So how does that, you know, granted, how does that resilience come about? Is it through repetitive processes that you finally recognize and realize? I call it excruciatingly fun.
Because excruciatingly fun. I would not frame them that way.
Well, they're excruciating in process, but they're fun to look back on and see your goal.
Oh, okay. Right? All right. Okay.
You know, we've got to figure out, you know, ways of framing things, honoring what's taken place, because we can't diminish any of our experiences, no matter how traumatic they may have been. They're important to have had, and they need to be honored, not necessarily attached, right? Because that's where you're talking about the growth from. So please continue about how that resilience then developed and how you recognized the resilience, easy for me to say, in you.
I think you touched on it briefly just a moment ago, that resilience, I think, is cultivated in repetition of experience. It's like resistance training. You know, you work a muscle, and the more that you work the muscle, the more resilient it becomes. Mm-hmm. And so that is true in every area of our life, that the more that we exercise something, the more we strengthen it. And in that, we experience the resilience.
So our being is like a big muscle.
Kind of.
Yeah, we work it, we develop it, we explore it, we're curious about it. We know it's there because there's that additional sense of it that comes through. We don't necessarily understand what it is yet because they're the curiosity, right? We're still developing it even at our age.
Yes.
And it's a beautiful thing. Now, when you were younger, what were the kinds of things that you found that helped you to recognize the processes or processes and how they became kind of consistent in your awareness of the pieces of the process and the structure and outcome? Is that a fair question?
Yes, absolutely. My first thought on that is that prayer has been probably one of the most consistent patterns since I was a child. But the way of executing that has changed dramatically over the years. You know, okay. when I was a child, I prayed as a child. And as I have matured and grown and come to understand that I don't need to beseech and I don't need to keep repeating myself. You know, I can speak honestly to the source of love about what's going on inside of me and trust that what I need will be given to me. And that's a pretty simple foundation to how I live. I believe that the resources are there for us in terms of resources beyond ourselves, but
is it a belief or is it an experience now, since you have had this process repeat itself so many times? Could we advance it to a state of knowing an experience system as opposed to a belief system?
Yes, absolutely. And honestly, I can't really tell you how or when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it was not a moment in time. It again has been a progression of awareness. And I suppose experientially, I become aware of it at those times when I find that I speak truth courageously.
Can't help yourself, huh?
Well, you probably have these moments, yes, where someone asks you a question or you respond to a situation and you just respond. And afterwards, it's almost like you didn't really realize that that's how you had responded. And, you know, we can call that channeling, or we can call it accessing some kind of intelligence within us that...
I find it's open, being open, willing, available, and ultimately vulnerable, because that's where the trust comes, right?
Yes.
So that you can be vulnerable to those inner promptings and allow yourself to speak when those come. It's like what is James Redfield in the Celestine Prophecy. Mm-hmm. I think it's the third insight, right? Where he's I forget the name of the guide, but he's teaching the people how to be quiet and only speak when that welling up comes from within. Now, I'm going to make a leap here and assume that that's exactly what you learned, and that through the experience of that repeatedly, you came to trust that and had a bit more of a fearless approach in speaking up when prompted to do so.
Yes, and I realized as we were kind of entering into this part of our conversation that when I am in that place of knowing, if you will, there is no fear. I can have beliefs that I hold to and I believe them, but there is a potential aspect of that that contains fear. It never occurred to me that when I am in that place of knowing, I do not feel fear.
Right.
That's a really important distinction. I don't think I've ever made that before. Thank you for that.
Oh, you're very welcome. I had a wonderful mentor years ago. I didn't believe in psychic attacks for a long time. And then I had one. And I avoided the outcome through a couple of friends of mine that grabbed me as my body started to come up off the floor. It was that strong. And had I not let go, I may not be here talking with you now, or I may not have been. But afterwards, I called this gentleman up and he'd had a doctorate from UCLA in metaphysics, and his specialty was demonology, witchcraft, and sorcery. Not that he wanted to perform it, that he wanted to know about it so that he could help protect himself and others. But what he said to me was that, don't resist, just let go. Have no fear. Don't argue. Don't get angry. Don't do anything when that happens. Just let it pass through. And what it ultimately led to was the greatest protection is no protection at all. Because you're in that place of total trust. You don't have any fear within you that allows that energy to attach to it.
Interesting. Yes.
And so this applies, from my experience, across the board, whether you're dealing with an individual in the workplace or a coworker or a boss or a mate, or some random person that, you know, is kind of acting out in public as well, and becoming an aggressor. Well, those kinds of things, we have a tendency to want to feed back what we get, right? So we want to react because we feel triggered immediately. And most of us don't have the awareness of the moment to recognize the trigger, hit the pause button, take a breath, and then respond, right? So is that kind of a process that you also learned in your resilience and being able to step up and be more present in those moments without the fear?
I don't know that that particularly resonates for me experientially.
Okay. It may not have.
I tend to not so much be reactionary. I'm more inclined to retreat.
Ah, okay.
So my protective posturing is a little bit different. And so what I have had to learn myself is, even if my instinct is to pull back and to close off my voice, that for me, what that sometimes means is, even if I do retreat or need to circle back, it's really important for me to return to a place of the knowing, of the clarity, of the truth, and then to step forward and to speak. So my cultivation of resilience is a little bit different of a cycle, but equally as challenging.
Sure. And we all have different methodologies in doing that. And some are similar, some aren't. And I really appreciate how you explained that process. And I think it would be really beneficial, will be, as others listen to it, who do have that tendency to withdraw. Because it is, we're not, unfortunately, in our society, we're not encouraged to stand on our own two feet and present our what we think and feel. It's more prescriptive based on groupthink as opposed to individuality. In some cases, that may not be a bad thing, but in most cases, that's a deterrent to real progress, in my opinion.
It certainly can be. And I think the other piece that's so important for us to appreciate is that we live in these human bodies that are wired to protect us in certain ways. So our nervous systems and our brain will respond instinctively in one of those ways, a fight, flight, or freeze, right? So we all have our developed patterns of survival, if you will, and to appreciate that those patterns are still present for us physiologically as we live in our bodies, and that the part of our transformation, part of our progression, is appreciating and honoring that, and also continuing to find our way in the cultivation of resilience and that foundational place of trust that I call returning to our essence.
Mm-hmm.
And that, sometimes that's a challenge when we're being activated neurologically. And so it's important for us to appreciate that and to understand that, yes, sometimes we will have these instinctive responses, part of our survival mechanism, and we can also move beyond those and return to the truth that we know about ourselves.
Absolutely. And we have, because of our evolutionary process, we've got to the place where we now have choice about what to do with that.
Yeah.
And that in a lot of cases, when those things happen, maybe more from an observational standpoint, we look around to check in to see if there's really any reason, right? Or is this just something that this energy that we feel that triggers this? And most often, I think that's the case. We hear something, we feel something, we see something that doesn't quite fit. And so we're in a moment of an unknown quantity or quality. And then that gives us that kind of instantaneous, oh, what's going to happen? And the funny thing is that there's that sensation that comes along that. How would you describe the sensation that comes with that? And where would it be located in your body if you could place it?
The sensation of what?
That feeling triggered.
Ah,
where does it begin?
Well, I would note the importance and the appreciation of the non-conscious mind that stores.
I'm talking on a feeling level, on a sensation, not a thinking level, but where would it register in your body first?
Well, it for a moment, let me continue with that
sure,
thought.
Yeah.
Because the non-conscious mind isn't about thinking. It's about that awareness that's out of our conscious awareness, out of our capacity to think, from which we often respond. And
true.
In that, it can often contain memories, and memories of things that perhaps have not been fully attended to. And so I can know sometimes if something is triggered, I will get that physical response. For me, very often it's in my solar plexus, because that's where I feel the challenge of my power, if you will.
Right.
And I don't know if you have this experience, but sometimes I'll say, damn, I thought I had attended to that. I thought I had worked that through, you know, all those years of therapy and meditation and self-reflection. And here it is, this pattern that is emerging up inside of me to be attended to. So for me, I experience it most often in what I call vulnerably powerful place in my body.
Right. And that was an exquisite answer. Thank you very much. That was what I was hoping that you would say, because in that solar plexus, that's where we connect with everything. According to this another system you may or may not be aware of, it's an indigenous philosophy of three brains, the gut, the heart, and the head. And that we feel everything in the gut, because that's where the vibrations of everything are tuned into by the body. That's where that sensory apparatus is. And we think it has to do with the will, right? Because it's often a will being imposed on us, or us trying to impose our will on something. And yet that sensation that occurs, there's two different directions you can go with it. One's to the anxiety side, the other's to the anticipation side, right? The curious side or the fearful side. And that's where we have that moment of, well, let me ask you this. Do you feel that in that place, that that's where that unconscious becomes conscious and our ability to choose where we go with it
arrives? Yes, yeah. And you make a valid point that we often experience both excitement and anxiety in that same central location in our body. So sometimes we have trouble differentiating it. Mm-hmm. Like we can think that maybe we're excited, but we might actually be anxious. Or we think that we're anxious, but we might actually be excited. When we talk about butterflies in the stomach, mm-hmm. it's that same sensation. And so part of our journey is being able to attune to that and say, okay, what is this? Is this anticipation, excitement, eagerness, or is this anxiety or fear? And that differentiation, even though it's felt in the same place in the body, is really, really important in terms of, as you said, our capacity to choose.
It's an amazing process, isn't it?
Yes.
So let's kind of turn the wheel back a little bit, and we won't step in the Wayback Machine. We started there and we left Peabody and Sherman where they were. So in coming forward, when you were in the decision process of to where you were going to go with your degrees and the educational process, what fed that?
For me, it was, it was my own personal therapy for me, which was a spiritual journey, essentially,
mm-hmm.
that took me the trajectory of my work into counseling, which then took me into my own private practice. And that had been sort of an established foundation while I was in ministry. So when I left the church, I stayed with my own private practice and began to do my work through that. And then it was the evolution of my own journey that affected and impacted my work as a healer, if you will. I have mixed feelings about that term because I'm not really the healer, right? I'm the teacher, but I don't heal you. You heal yourself, right?
You're just the facilitator.
The facilitator, because absolutely.
And not only did you go into private practice, you had two clinics at one point, and that's a major accomplishment and speaks to your acumen and how you're able to do things and the effectiveness.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And it deserves honor as well as respect, because you've gone not just built the business, you've lived it, which is much more powerful. You know, so many therapists go through the process and I find, you know, most people in the healing arts in some way are there simply because of themselves. It's not about trying to heal other people. They're trying to fix themselves first. And of course, you have to do that. We can't love anybody deeply or even shallowly until we really get in touch with our love for ourselves. Because without that, we can't give fully to others. Now, how did that, speaking of, would you agree with that? And how did that play out for you in your ability to not only learn it, but to express it to others?
Well, I think that's very accurate that for me, it has always been both and. Mm-hmm. That my own journey of healing was so fascinating that I decided that I wanted to learn more about that process, and that I then wanted to participate as a clinician in that process with people. And so as I grew, as I healed, as I matured, as I transformed, as I expanded in my awarenesses, to that degree, it has impacted my work. And honestly, my work today is so much easier than it was when I was younger. I had to work really hard at it. And so after these years of experience and cultivation of my own internal resources, my work now flows very, very easily for me and has a level of enjoyment and satisfaction that I didn't have early on. But that's what happens as we mature.
I was just going to say, isn't that the joy of maturity, right? Mm-hmm. We realize, hopefully, not everybody does. In this, was there a moment when you had the notion that maybe even that there's a greater connection between both the inner and outer worlds and how one reflects the other?
Well, certainly we know as it is within, as it is without, yes?
Mm.
I tend to see my external experiences as an opportunity of reflection for what is happening inside of me, and that it's a feedback, if you will, about where I'm at in my own inner journey.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about helping me to course correct with my own choices. So that's how I understand my external experiences in relationship to my internal experiences.
Now that takes a tremendous amount of self-awareness, right? How do you suggest that folks build that self-awareness? What are some of the things that they can do for themselves that help to build that?
I think some of the most satisfying time for me in my own growth process is when I find a private, relaxed space to just allow my mind to ask all kinds of questions about whatever. I suppose maybe you could call that meditation, a self-reflection. It's probably something akin to when people journal. I've never been a journaling person myself,
mm-hmm.
but just to be in that space.
Conversations with self.
Like a conversation with self where I can just be curious. Now, the challenge in that is that sometimes one, if we're
which
not-
which voice asking, is going to answer, right?
Well, I was actually thinking sometimes, you know, if I'm not asking good questions, I can think circularly, right? I can keep coming back and right. not really answer anything. But I guess I'm never afraid of the answers, again, because I trust the process of curiosity. And I feel safe in that curiosity. So for me, that is a really important part of my own self-exploration. And also, I love to read. I love to study. I love conversations with people who are curious and they like to learn and explore. And that's an external experience that helps cultivate the growth of my own inner awareness. So I think there's time for solitude and reflection. I think there's a time for conversation and interaction, and that both can be very, very useful in gaining clarity about who we really are, how we want to show up, what's important to us, what's purposeful, mm-hmm. and that's the juice and the quality of our lives.
It really is. So let me ask, let's unpack this inner conversation just a little bit more. Do you find that there are two, not necessarily opposing, but definitely two voices that are conversing with self. And as you're listening to those two voices, is there occasionally a third voice that comes in as the voice of wisdom?
Yes, there is a school of thought in therapy called family parts therapy, I believe it's called, where they talk okay. about the different parts of the self
okay.
that are in conflict or conversation. Some people have one or two voices. Some of us have committees inside of us. And so, yes, there can be these voices that are very often fueled by fear or anxiety, of uncertainty, not knowing what to do, making a decision, whatever. But then there is this voice, if we become acquainted with that voice, that is really what I call our divine intelligence.
It doesn't show up very often, but it's there.
Well, you know what? I think it's available a lot more than we appreciate.
Totally agree.
And I have really become more acquainted with that part of myself and foundationally who I am in that. And I find that when I trust that wisdom, and as you say, I may not always necessarily like the answer or the directive that I'm given, meaning that I would like sometimes for the answers to be easier.
Mm-hmm.
But
okay. Go ahead.
But I find that if I trust that and I allow that part of myself to speak, the truth of that is calming to those parts of myself that are afraid.
Hmm. So there is an empathic resonance in your being with that notion of truth, whatever that might be.
Yes, I call that the part of myself that holds the compassionate truth.
Hmm. Yeah. Sometimes it doesn't feel so compassionate, and yet, right?
Well, you know, sometimes truth can...
What cuts through? And that cutting through
it
is
can, how it can have sometimes, yeah, sometimes it can but we also know, I think about when a boil is lanced, how painful that can be, and mm-hmm. how not pretty mm-hmm. that is, but once that takes place and the toxicity is released, then the healing begins. So if we can trust that sometimes painful opening of that toxicity, the relief of it, we know, is worth even the pain.
Absolutely. And that's just with the personal self. Now, what about relationships? When you're in a toxic relationship, what can you do? What are some of the best things to do when you finally recognize that you're in a toxic relationship? Does the same process apply?
Well, it's a bit different, I suppose, at least as I frame it in my own mind, that when you're in a relationship, you have two different people on their journeys. Mm-hmm. And if you're in a relationship with someone that you're experiencing as toxic, meaning that you know that when you're around them and your energy changes, diminishes, it has an impact on you where you are less energetic or your energetic level is lower, it's really important to pay attention to that. And it leaves you then with a decision, a couple of decisions. Do you talk with this person about your experience and negotiate a different way of relating with them?
Mm-hmm.
Do you decide to limit your exposure to that person? Or do you make a decision to disengage from a relationship? And by that, I mean you change the form of that relationship. For example, if you are in a marriage where your experience with your partner is not building you up and supporting you, and you're not healthy in that, then if you make a choice to leave that relationship, you don't actually leave the relationship per se, you change the form of that relationship, meaning you decide to divorce or to separate or whatever. Because mm-hmm. we don't really disconnect in our relationships because we're all connected, right? But the form of our relationship and the investment of our energy in a relationship can change.
Right.
And sometimes we have to set boundaries. And I heard Brené Brown a couple weeks ago. I was listening to, I believe it was her podcast, and she was saying in her most recent book that the people who are most compassionate, research has shown that they are also the people who have the strongest boundaries, which I thought was really interesting. And I think that it is true. And so sometimes in our self-care, one of the most important things we can do is to set a boundary, is to say, stop, or no, or I won't participate in that, or I won't engage in that toxicity.
Well, that's where the fear of rejection comes up too, of not being understood, of being lashed out or aggressed upon, or any number of toxic outcomes, right? More toxic outcomes.
Yes. Yes. And again, you know, that anticipation of, you know, not belonging or not fitting in is instinctive for us, because we are tribal by nature.
Mm-hmm.
We need to belong for our own survival. We need connection for our own satisfaction. So it's understandable that we weigh our decisions about, is this going to put me in a position of not being safe? Is this going to put me in a position of not being connected? Am I going to experience a loss if I make this decision? Those are important questions to ask.
Absolutely. And yet they need to be asked, and the better we can do that, and as you've offered here, there are ways to ask those kinds of questions that aren't necessarily threatening to you, yet there are necessary questions that need to be asked, and then listening to that inner wisdom as to what to do about it, because that will also come, if not already encouraged by others around you prior to, right? Because a lot of times people can see what's going on and they'll comment to you about it before you even recognize it, because you sometimes get used to it and it becomes, your activity becomes coping strategies with it rather than actually addressing it, which is tremendously debilitating and diminishing to both in relationship, because neither one of you grow in that way. Now, and the same thing seems to happen in different ways in the working world, right? You don't leave a job because you don't like your job. It's usually because you don't like your boss. And he or she has created a toxic environment that is just intolerable to you. How do we shift that? In the workplace, you and I both do business consulting and coaching. How would you address that in a workplace? And what are some suggestions that you might offer that people can experiment with?
There's any number of ways I could respond to that, yes? Part of what's challenging about a work environment is that sometimes it takes on elements of our history, meaning that bosses become authority figures. And so if we have...
Kind of archetypal in nature is what you're saying.
Well, yes, or more specifically, thinking about it in terms of what psychologically is called transference, that we can sometimes experience an authority figure as a parental figure.
Right.
And if that stuff gets confused inside of us, it becomes problematic, because then we tend to respond out of some childlike part of ourselves rather than from our adult awareness, or what we would call our divine intelligence. Mm-hmm. So I think part of what is important is to explore that. Is any part of this dynamic that's going on, for example, with your boss, does any of this feel familiar to you historically? If it does, then you kind of need to attend to that inside yourself. Like, am I perpetuating this in any way? Am I kind of dancing a dance here that's keeping this going? Well, if that's the case, then we have a responsibility to kind of own that and determine, can I respond in a different way that might change the dynamic in this setting? So I think that's important to keep in mind. If we determine, however, that no, we're in a place of clarity and this is just a really tough place to be, and this person is abusive and unappreciative and whatever it is that is toxic in the environment, then we have to make a decision. Are we going to talk with that person about the discomfort? There's also the possibility, do we go to HR? But at some point, we're going to have to make a decision. Am I going to stay or am I going to leave? Mm-hmm. And if we decide that it's going to be necessary to leave, then the next part of that is, as best we can, is to plan a strategy of exit. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people just, they wait till they get to the end of the rope and then they blow up and they storm out and they don't know where they're going to go and they don't have a plan in place. Now, sometimes you just have to do what you have to do, right? You need to make that exit. Yeah. But if we
sometimes those events, you have no idea they're coming and all of a sudden, boom.
Yes. Yeah, that can happen. However, if there is the possibility to put a strategy in place and begin to make a plan, and this is true even in personal relationships, you know, if you're going to leave, for example, an abusive relationship, it's really important to have an exit strategy in place to do that.
You know, that this is one area where you're talking about strategic planning, right? Our lives, we're the project managers for our lives, right? So this doesn't just apply to relationships. This strategy and the capacity to make them is really beneficial for our entire lives, not just the relationships that we have and moving in and out of toxicity.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that I find that really, and I don't recall when I finally, you know, made that observation and garnered the awareness of it, you know, because we're making choices. We're selling ourselves to ourselves all of the time, and then attempting to sell that person that we think we are to others in hopes for acceptance and acknowledgement and the safety and security that comes with that kind of environment. Now, do you think that in this period we're in, I'm going to jump from that into kind of a global perspective and what you think or feel about where we're at now in regard to the last couple of years and the progress we're making and coming out into this new world that didn't exist a couple of years ago? How do you see this kind of process accentuating the positive growth?
I would return to the metaphor I talked about earlier. I think the boil has been lanced. I think that we are seeing a lot of really putrid, toxic, smelly, awful stuff. We are seeing the dark side of our human experience in ways that I think had been sort of kept polished for a long time. And it's generated a lot of fear on the planet, and that fear is being fueled. But for those of us who know the truth of who we are, it's an amazing time to live because we have an opportunity to step forward and extend love and light and compassion and truth to ourselves and to those around us. And so it makes it an incredibly miraculous time to live right now, even as we see all of this chaos and uncertainty, to be able to be clear about the truth that we know, and to be able to offer that is a profound opportunity.
Totally agree. And so many things, especially in the virtual world, are just becoming more available. People are gathering where they couldn't. And now, especially with this worldwide web access, that it's not everywhere. It's in enough places where people of vastly different cultures and theologies even can come together and begin sifting through the rubble in order to find something to rebuild with. Now, do you also feel that there's almost an emerging experience that's coming from this, that's kind of a natural movement toward better living on with each other on Earth? And that, of course, it's not going to happen overnight, and we never think about the, you know, 10 to 15 year research and development timelines in most corporations already, but we need to do that in our lives now. We're faced with it. What are we going to do? How are we going to behave? One of the key aspects of the global peace movement that I got involved with, and pretty much the reason I did, there was two rules: don't be an aggressor, be a good human. Well, we have that sense of what it is to be a good human when we step out of the way of that fear. Now, how would you suggest that acknowledgement and that even intuitive sense of being a good human, how we might be able to better pay attention to that within us and what we might do as a result.
You know, one of my greatest challenges in my human experience
is being asked questions by Zen, right?
No, I like your questions. I love good questions, and I love curious questions.
Well, the interesting thing is that as I ask them, I've got to answer my own questions. I sometimes don't know the questions come from.
Isn't just that awesome?
Like, okay, let's explore.
It's totally awesome. I think one of the greatest challenges for me in my human experience is when I see people make decisions that are destructive or harmful or aggressive to other human beings. When I see humans making stupid decisions, my greatest challenge is to feel compassion for them. Because I understand that when humans are being unkind and abusive and treating one another badly, those individuals that are responding in that way are responding out of woundedness inside of themselves. And it's really tough because that isn't about excusing their choices. It's about being really clear that that's not okay to do. It's not okay in our human experience to treat each other unkindly.
And yet we have to take like your original upbringing, we go back to the guy and Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, right? That fits. That's exactly what we have to do.
And for me, that is the greatest challenge for me to stay focused from a compassionate lens, because I get annoyed, I get angry. I feel deep sadness when people are mistreated, but it's really important that I don't become entangled or entrenched in that experience, in that emotional experience.
Right, because you become just like them.
Right, you're kind of buying into the perpetrator victim kind of
the toxicity,
and that doesn't serve anyone. But for me to be able to look at someone and say, you know, that was a horrendous thing that happened, and yet I can feel compassion for them because if they would have known a better choice, they would have made it. And by no, I mean no, not believe cognitively or intellectually, right? But if they would have known a better way, they would have done it better. And that's for me, that's the greatest challenge in my human experience, is to stay in that place of compassion.
Now that's a place where you're observing, right?
Yeah.
Would you interact, or would you simply observe, or would it depend on the situation?
It would probably depend on the situation. You know, if I felt that there was some sort of signal inside of myself that would say participate in some way, I would participate. If I did not feel that signal, I would not.
Good. That's what I
would maintain that position of observing, and choosing to participate in a way that I might feel is meaningful, but getting entangled.
Only in your own mind at the time, right?
And getting entangled in the toxicity doesn't really help anyone. Yeah.
No, it doesn't. However, another kind of entanglement does. And that would be quantum entanglement, where you are thinking that compassionate thought and it permeates, ripples, connects, however it does in some small way, because as you mentioned earlier, we are connected. And you know, I was talking with Dr. Irvin Laszlo a while back, and we were talking, we kind of broached the quantum physics topic, and you know, the current thinking is we're 99% space and 1% material. And he says, I would argue that we're 100% energy. Mm-hmm. And I had to agree. It just, I had that empathic resonant moment, right? The truth, when you feel it, you can't deny it. You can try everything you want to, but you know that resonance when it happens. And that, speaking to your, whether you engage or not, that's that inner awareness. That's that knowing of, yes, you can do something in this moment, and here's what you can do. That comes from that divine intelligence spot you were talking about. And then there's the other side of recognizing it, not giving it power by directing judgment, and instead feeling the compassion and just observing and offering that, in essence, energetic loving embrace from a distance. And that's really about all you can do. And yet it's something you can do. Non-action in that place is still action.
Yes, and we have no idea how our thoughts or emotions or actions are rippling out into the world. Mm.
Sometimes you get a clue.
Sometimes we do, yeah. But sometimes we don't. And I think that's the beauty of our experience, because if you believe in quantum physics, if you believe in the holographic part of that, we experience something here and it's experienced way over there in the same way. We have no idea. I don't think at this point in our human experience, we have no idea where we are right now of the true power of who we are and the choices that we make now.
Very true. Now, there are some indicators as to what's possible. Not that we're experiencing it yet. Some do. I've had moments of serendipity and synchronicity that are just too connected there are no coincidences, as we know. But these kind of moments actually edify the fact that there are no coincidences. But there's a memoirs of a guy named Wilbert Smith, who was the project manager for Canada's UFO investigation in the 1950s. Odd thing, I know I'm pulling it in out of nowhere. However, it's specific to this, where it was shared with him from other intelligences that he engaged in this 10-year process, and well-respected scientist of his own right. He asked the pertinent questions. One of those answers about our constructs of reality, they relayed to him that we start from a point of awareness, and our reality is determined by our awareness, not our projections.
Interesting. I like that.
And it made sense, because from that still place within, the more you can become, the more you question, the more you go within, the deeper you go, and there's so many worlds that to experience inside and out, the more we're able to craft a better environment because of how we're perceiving, not necessarily what we're perceiving. One of the other things that they said to him was that their understanding of time isn't by clock, it's by the measurement in the change of entropy. So that would indicate, as we evolve, that entropy lessens. And so in that harmony that takes place, it's not necessary that chaos disappears, because chaos really only, it's patterns we don't recognize yet and or understand and make useful. So it just seems totally chaotic. Yet science and math is behind it all. That in that process, it is conceivable that we, in acting more in harmony with each other, that it would truncate the time it would take for a global transformation. That's one of the things I'm hopeful for.
I agree with you, and I do believe that the experience of awakened consciousness continues to expand, even by virtue of the opportunities that we have, say virtually. You and I are connecting here in a way that we wouldn't have been able to, you know, 5-10 years ago, right? How amazing is that? And so the opportunity for the collective conscious to raise in its vibrational frequency, the potential for that to continue is very, very real. And I do believe that there are many of us who are connecting deliberately and thoughtfully and in a committed way of participating in this transformation and in this elevation of our energy.
I certainly
am. Very exciting.
You are too. It really is. And it's evidence of the greater happening.
Yes.
And my energy and spikes, you know, I talk with people like you and from all over the world, and it's so exciting. It's enthralling to have these kinds of inspired, curious, generative conversations that really peel back the layers of the onion of our own being so that we can look at things in a little deeper way and maybe garner a little more understanding. At the very least, we got more questions.
Absolutely. And you know, for me, it's very enriching in that we kind of touched on this earlier. I need that interaction with kindred spirits. I need to be able to connect with people that understand, with whom I resonate, because there is so much fear-based thinking around us. And so it's very, very important that we have and cultivate these connections.
Absolutely. We're kind of running long on time, which is fine. It's just, I never know where these are going to go. So it's wonderful just to have the time. And I hope the audience has patience. It's a lot, you know, I'm sure that they're interested. In a parting way, what kind of advice might you give for dealing with an everyday life and a simple activity that one might do or participate in that could garner and help build their self-awareness?
We talked earlier about the importance of choices. And in my book, Freed from Stuck, I talk about crossing a bridge from stuck to freed from stuck. And sometimes I will say to people, here's two questions for you. And these are important questions at any choice point. If I make this choice, how will it impact me? How will it affect those that I love? How will it influence my community? What will be the long-term ramifications of this choice? And if I don't make this choice, how will it impact me? How will it impact those around me? How will it influence my world? How will it affect my life long-term? And when we begin to ask those kinds of questions as we are standing at a choice point, it allows us to become clear about the best choice, the direction to take, the outcome that we really want. And so I would leave that as a very sort of practical way of stepping forward into our lives, into our future, and say, ask yourself those questions at the crossroad in order to make the choices that are going to take you to the highest quality of life.
Awesome. What a wonderful parting gift. Thank you so much for your time, Susie, and just the wonderful conversation and the wisdom that you carry and are able to share is exquisite. Thank you.
Thank you.
And namaste and in la catch. Thank you so much for sticking with us for this episode of One World in a New World. I'm Zen Benefiel, your host, and I will see you next time.